Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
Last year, organizers of the Sundance Film Festival announced it was leaving Park City, and maybe Utah, for good. After years of struggling with limited theaters, soaring lodging costs, and overwhelming crowds, they said the festival had simply outgrown the town, so they launched a search for a new home. Utah was still in the running, but it had to make a pitch like everyone else. And this is kind of like an Olympics bid. You offer incentives, you promise funding and facilities, and last Thursday, the festival's board voted. In 2027, they're moving to Boulder, Colorado, the creative, tech-savvy college town that also happens to be 10 times the size of Park City. And people around here couldn't believe it. Sundance was leaving Utah. The Sundance Kid was Robert Redford's character, and Utah was Robert Redford's home. People figured that connection alone would clinch the deal, if not Utah's long history with the festival. It's a history the Salt Lake Tribune's Sean Means laid out for us.
The festival started as the Utah U.S. Film Festival in September 1978 in Salt Lake City, did a couple years here, and then in their third year, the suggestion was made by Sidney Pollack, the filmmaker, the guy that directed Redford in The Way We Were and 3 Days of the Condor. He said, you know what you ought to do? You ought to move it into Park City in January. You'd be the only film festival in a ski town during ski season. Hollywood would just beat down the door to go. And then 4 years later, Sundance took over operations of the United States Film Festival. And one of the first movies that played in 1985 was the Coen brothers' first movie, Blood Simple.
I love you too.
No. You're just saying that because you're scared.
And then in 1989, the first $1 million distribution sale made at the festival was Sex, Lies, and Videotape, Steven Soderbergh's first movie.
So what do you think Elizabeth is going to think about all these videotapes?
First deal of its kind.
I can't imagine her being too understanding.
That's what really put Sundance on the map. Then everybody had to go to Sundance to see what the big thing was and see if they could buy it before somebody else did. What was unique was you actually got to be super close to the people making the movies. You could wind up on a shuttle bus with some director. I wound up on a shuttle bus once talking to Faye Dunaway. It was difficult to get to because it was the mountains and it was snowy. It was difficult to get into the festival. You had hundreds and later thousands of films trying to get into the festival, and only a few get picked. That was by design in Redford's mind, that it should be hard. You got to sacrifice a little bit. You got to put some skin in the game. And the reward for that was that you got to have an experience at the festival where you show your movie and you don't know what the audience is going to do. And they give you a very honest, very strong appraisal, and if your movie's good, you get the applause, you get the recognition, you get the standing ovation, and then you get the deal. And it would happen, you know, in the ski lodge, in the bar after the screening was over. It would happen in the car in the parking lot where the producer was waiting for the news to find out what happened. And you're dealing on a level where you could go from nothing to being a big name. People like, you know, Robert Rodriguez, who spent $7,000 to make El Mariachi. And that made his reputation. And pretty much every film and every filmmaker that came through Sundance had a story like that. You know, Kevin Smith with Clerks. The number of stories like that that came out of Sundance built the reputations of those filmmakers, but it also built Sundance's reputation that it was someplace you could come if you just had an idea and a good story and some talent, you could build something big.
A This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Sundance leaving Utah. There's the economic impact. The festival generated about $132 million for the state last year. But there's also a cultural impact, which is harder to measure. And then there's the question of why. Did Utah's conservative politics push the festival away? Or in the end, was it just about logistics and infrastructure and a state that just couldn't keep up with Sundance's growth? Let's go back to Sean Means.
The issue for Sundance deciding that they needed to get out of Park City, or at least consider the idea of getting out of Park City, was an outgrowth of their success. Because they were successful, because people in the Hollywood industry needed to be in Park City to get these gems, to find these discoveries. And because the crowds were here, because the people, the thousands of people who liked going to Sundance and wanted to be part of that atmosphere, it ultimately was just overwhelming for Park City. And so after the 2024 festival, Sundance announced, well, okay, our contract is up in 2 years with the city of Park City. Let's explore the options. Let's see what is out there. And so they did a year-long bid submission process. They had 60 or 70 cities make initial offers or initial signs of interest. From that, they sent invitations to about 15 to make initial proposals. From those initial proposals, they narrowed it down to six. From those six, they narrowed it down to three finalists. And three finalists were Boulder, Colorado, Cincinnati, Ohio, and then a combined bid of Salt Lake City and Park City, which seemed to be the status quo bid, but it really wasn't, because that bid, the Salt Lake City bid, is really a Salt Lake City bid. It wasn't. Yeah. Park City might have had some small residual events. I think the idea was that they would treat Park City the way they used to treat the Sundance Resort, right, where they would have a small sort of curated program for the people that lived up there, but that the bulk of the festival would be down in Salt Lake City.
What interests you about the way that process played out? What is it that that Sundance was looking for when they went through those bids? What were the characteristics that mattered to them? We'll get to whether place mattered. I mean, clearly place matters. But like, what was the other stuff that interested them that they were looking at, as far as you can tell?
What I have heard is they were looking to see what would be a good fit for what Sundance does. Largely, they were looking at venues.
Yeah.
They wanted to make sure they had enough theaters. They were also looking for something that was kind of compact, someplace that's walkable, even in January. There's intangibles as well. Does the city have the people that are going to want to come be part of a festival? Are they going to have, do they have a local audience? Do they have a local art scene that feels supported and feels welcomed? And would they welcome another arts organization into that mix?
What do you make of the final decision being Boulder in this sense? It doesn't seem like a coincidence that it's a mountain town, that it has mountains in the backdrop, that it's close to a university. Or is that a coincidence? It seems like in some ways, this is Park City, but bigger and with better venues, and they just like the vibe of it being snowy there. What do you make of that?
One guy I know talks about Boulder being the safe choice amongst the three, because it's not a big city. It's not like Cincinnati or Salt Lake City, which is where you're in a downtown in a major city, right, or a mid-sized metropolitan area. So you still get a little of that close, small town vibe. I mean, Boulder is 100,000 people. It's 10 times the size of Park City, but it's not 100 times the size of Park City the way, you know, Salt Lake area or the Cincinnati area or bigger cities that they thought about, like San Francisco and Atlanta. So it's not going to get swallowed up by the big city. I think that Boulder, it has that feel. It's still mountains in the background. You're still going to feel that mountain vibe. You're not as close to the ski resorts as Park City was, as you are in Park City.
Right.
But you do get that sensibility and you get that sort of closeness. The other thing Boulder has going for it is that you have a college. You have University of Colorado at Boulder right there, and you've got a big college audience. And so they want to hook into that as well.
What was the clincher? Any idea?
They won't say. They say it's a lot of little things. One of the interesting quotes that I've seen from all the comments from Sundance officials was that a welcoming community that shared Sundance's ethos. And Sundance's ethos can go a lot of different directions. Mostly they're talking about, you know, sort of spirit of discovery, of risk-taking storytelling, that kind of thing. But welcoming community, I think, is a key phrase, because I think there were many people, both Sundance attendees and people, who were feeling maybe that Utah wasn't as welcoming as it used to be. And that's where we get into the politics.
Right.
Sundance has said officially, politics was not a decision. It was not a factor in the decision making.
Let me underline that. Ebs, you include this in your writing. Ebs Bernau, of the chair of the Institute's board, one of the things he told you was, look, we're used to the politics of Utah, and that it wasn't, as he put it, a major part of how we addressed this process. So on its face, it's like he said, the short answer is no, it didn't. For example, the pride flag issue that came up during the legislative session, that wasn't a clincher. But it sounds like it might be more complicated than that.
I think it is more complicated than that, because, I mean, Ebs Bernau said that the politics were not a factor in the decision. And you notice from comments from the Tribune readers, comments from people in the industry, comments from all around, nobody believes him. Nobody is buying that. Nobody. And I have no reason to doubt Ebs, you know, that he's sincere in what he says. But you're also dealing with an industry that has a fairly solid LGBTQ component to it. Good many people in the industry, good many people who are moviegoers and in the arts world are in the LGBTQ community. And they could read the papers too, and they could see what was being said and what was being passed in the legislature. And not just this year with the Pride Flag bill, but also, last year with the bills to ban gender-affirming care for teenagers or to not allow trans kids in women's sports in high schools in Utah. Bills like that, message bills that got passed very quickly. You know, Governor Cox couldn't wait to sign the trans sports bill. And that, you know, that may speak to that whole welcoming community aspect that Sundance did mention as being one of the things they liked about Boulder.
Sean, how much does the place really matter to a film festival? I mean, clearly it's connected to the very name is connected to a lot of festivals, but can Sundance just pull up stakes and move the operation to Colorado? And the setting, and I don't just mean the backdrop of the mountains, but the place, does it make a difference? I guess for me, it raises the question of just how connected was Utah? Because I've been asking this question all week. How connected is Utah, was Utah, to the Sundance Film Festival?
That's going to be the question that we find out in 2027 when it's not here and it's somewhere else. Here's the thing. In 2024, there were some 75,000 people who attended the Sundance Film Festival.
Right.
A third of them were from out of state. That means there are about 50,000 people who attended the Sundance Film Festival who live in Utah. That is 50,000 movie fans who have grown up with 40 years of the Sundance Film Festival, that have grown up learning how to watch movies because Sundance taught them how to. That is 50,000 people who have learned to love movies and love independent movies and love risk-taking out there movies because they would see them at Sundance. That is not going to be easy to replace. Those 50,000 people aren't going to be at the 2027 Sundance Film Festival. Some of them might go, a few might go, but now they're going to have to find 50,000 different people, and they're going to have to train them how to watch movies. And it's going to have an effect on the response that the audiences give to the movies that play at Sundance when it's in Boulder. I think they'll get there. I think the folks in Boulder are, you know, they're going to be deeply appreciative in the first couple of years. And then over time, they're going to get trained. They're going to learn how to appreciate independent films and appreciate the programming and the ideals that Sundance has been espousing for all these years.
Governor Cox said, of course, he thought that they had made a mistake. Obviously, it's what he's going to say. But one of the things he mentioned is that we're going to start a new festival, one that, as he put it, honors our legacy and writes the next chapter of independent film in Utah. How is something like that going to work? Could Spencer Cox, along with someone like Ryan Smith, his name's been thrown into the mix, could they build a replacement film festival to Sundance? What do you make of that?
I honestly don't know.
Yeah.
I think it's possible. I mean, anything is possible. I think it is not something you're going to do overnight. I mean, Sundance did not arrive overnight. It took 40 plus years to build the Sundance Film Festival into what it was in Utah. You're not going to recreate that in a short amount of time.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this finally. Do you think for Sundance in particular and just film festivals in general, those early days that you were mentioning, the days when you had young, exciting filmmakers like Rodriguez and Soderbergh, and you had films, quirky films like Clerks, and you're rubbing shoulders with movie stars on buses, and you're sending your film out there, and you don't know what the audience is going to do, and if they do recognize it, there possibly could be some kind of deal. In an era of streaming, when a lot of these deals are done elsewhere, like, are those days gone, do you think?
At the 2025 festival, there was a lot of talk about how there weren't a lot of deals made.
Yeah.
It took several days before the first sort of $10 million whatever deal happened. And it was a body horror movie with Alison Brie and Dave Franco called Together. There weren't that many deals like that. In the past few years, you've noticed that the streamers, Netflix, Hulu, Apple TV, they were buying a lot because they have this ravenous maw that requires being fed content.
Yeah.
The streamers have decided in the last couple of years have sort of backed off from that because they make their own content, and they also make content that's a lot cheaper than spending $10 million, $15 million, $20 million at Sundance. Or they spend $100 million or $200 million for some massive movie like Electric State, which Netflix just came out with. And then it makes a bit of a splash and then never doesn't come back. The movies at Sundance are not the blockbusters. They are not the, you know, $200 million superhero-driven franchise movies that the big studios rely on to make their, you know, annual reports.
Yeah.
So they are frequently seen as the farm team, as the AAA talent pool that the majors then pick from to get their next big movie out. You look at the number of people who've directed Marvel movies who, you know, got their start in movies that were playing at Sundance, like Mia DaCosta or Ryan Fleck and Anna Boden. They started at Sundance and then they get a movie, you know, they get a couple movies under the belt, and then suddenly they're having to do a giant, you know, multi-million dollar movie with green screens and special effects. And we're seeing that happening. Actually, the next, we have Jared Hess, Utah's own Jared Hess, director of Napoleon Dynamite. He has a Minecraft movie coming out in theaters on April 4th. So, you know, that's the way, that's one way Hollywood looks at Sundance is a talent farm. That I think will remain. That will be the case with festivals no matter what. And then the other question becomes, the movies that play Sundance aren't necessarily the ones that are going to get somebody a career. They're not being done because they think they're going to make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. They're movies that are made because the people who make them have to make them or they're going to die. Right. You know, the whatever artistic thing is in them, they are going to make that movie. They have to tell this story. They have to get it out there, or it's going to fester in their brains and in their hearts.
Yeah.
And they're not going to be able to function unless they can get it out there and tell other people. If you want a capsule definition of what a Sundance movie is, that's it. That'll be the case no matter where Sundance goes.
Yeah. Sean Means, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Sean Means, he's deputy enterprise editor for the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, where Easter baskets can be filled with chef-prepared holiday meals, Easter lilies, Easter candy, and more.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the Sundance Film Festival, which you know by now is leaving Utah for Boulder, Colorado in 2027. Festival organizers went through an extensive process to find a new home. More than 100 different cities expressed interest. They winnowed it down to 67 and then 13 and then 3. The festival had certain infrastructure requirements, but it also had expectations of public money. Utah's legislature approved $3.5 million for the festival, and Colorado lawmakers also authorized money, a tax credit package of $34 million, though they only passed that on Friday. That was the day after the state won the bid. We spoke with Geralyn Dreyfuss this week. Dreyfuss has a long history with the festival. She's a film producer, but also founder of the Utah Film Center, and I should mention that's an organization we work with. She also co-founded an investment group that funds documentary films.
I was not surprised because I knew we were one of three finalists, and I felt like we were given the courtesy by Sundance of waiting to not make a decision until after our legislative session so that we could absolutely demonstrate that there would be financial support from the Utah legislature, of which we had a unanimous bill passed.
Yeah.
So basically, I knew it was going to be tough, and I knew that Boulder was our competition.
Yeah.
But I felt that we were going to win because Colorado had not passed their appropriation. It had passed in the House, but not in the Senate, and they had had one-third opposition in the House. So there was some chance that the Senate was not going to make a $34 million tax incentive appropriation, and I just could not believe that they would authorize the contract without having that, you know,
guaranteed,
finalized,
yeah.
Guaranteed. So I was both surprised and, quite frankly, kind of outraged. Hmm. Honestly, it just wasn't professional, you know. And I think it took me a day to go from being really mad to resigned the result. Right. Like, you know, there's nothing we can do about it. They've made a decision. I think they've made the wrong decision. I think they've made a very short-sighted decision. I think they don't understand in this marketplace what's happening to festivals and to film, to go ahead and do a startup, you know, from scratch in a new community. As someone that loves Sundance, I think it's like putting the brand and the whole enterprise at risk, because Utah has 70% of its ticket sales come from local residents. You're not going to get 70% of your ticket sales in the state of Colorado in year one. That took us 4 years to get to 7% of our ticket sales coming from local audiences. So there's a lot of things that I think could go wrong in Colorado that will jeopardize an institution that I care a lot about. And I think that will put at risk a marketplace for an industry that is on very wobbly footing. Like right now, it is so hard to make independent films and get them sold.
How do you explain the fact that, as you say, they didn't have the money necessarily guaranteed from the legislature, and Sundance went ahead anyway and made the decision that they did? Because it seems like, maybe this is not the way to put it, the fix was in. Like, was there really much the state could or anyone do to change their mind about leaving the festival, according to Redford and others? Said if they outgrew the place and there wasn't anything you guys could do about it.
No, that's not true. Okay, so they outgrew Park City,
yeah,
for sure. Okay, so let's back up. So Park City had gotten too expensive, quite frankly. I mean, you couldn't afford to come there as a filmmaker, and part of that had to do with greed on the part of people that were renting their homes and hotel rooms, right?
Hmm.
So you can't be an independent filmmaker and be expected to pay $1,000 a night, you know, which is the average room rate now in Park City,
yeah.
right? And did it outgrow the festival? Sure. I mean, the traffic is horrendous in Park City. And the biggest thing that changed was the stupid Epic passes. So it was the ski industry, ironically, that made the traffic so bad for Park City. So I think the traffic and the room rates were why people felt like, oh, this is not sustainable anymore. And that was a legitimate reason to evaluate at the end of a contract whether you should renew it. But the real thing that happened was that Redford sold the resort.
Right.
The resort made a guarantee that they would continue the labs, but they decided within their purview to renovate and upgrade the facilities, right? Mm. Completely understandable. Well, that renovation of a new lodging, a new chairlift, new infrastructure took the labs out of commission for 2 years, right? They couldn't do it. Everything was under construction. So Colorado very adroitly called up and said, we'll take the labs and we'll host you for free. So for the last 2 years, the director's lab and I can't remember which other lab, either two or three labs have been at the Stanley Hotel for free, hosted by the state of Colorado. And then the governor called up the chairman of the board and said, hey, as long as we have the labs, why don't we bring the whole festival here? And, you know, as a board member, which I'm not, I would have to say if somebody called me with that offer and my contract was up and the venues were getting to be as extensive as they were in Park City, it makes complete sense to me that a governing body of an institution would say, you know what? Our contract's up in 2 years. Maybe we should put this out to bid. Maybe we should really see, you know, where else we should be. So that's what happened.
Yeah. How connected was the Sundance Film Festival to Utah? There's some argument that outside of having Utahns go to the films, and it wasn't really part of the state itself. So how actually connected to the cultural landscape was Sundance to Utah, do you think?
I think that the board is very disconnected to what it means to be in Utah. I think people flew in to Utah. I think they experienced a very high level of service and accommodations, and it was a world-class festival. Hmm. But the perceptions of our state by the board and by industry members, quite frankly, and by members of the press, doesn't matter that they came here every year.
Yeah.
I mean, you know this, and I know this because of the Utah Film Center. Every time we brought a filmmaker back, they would say, you were the best interview they've ever made. And they've said the Utah audiences were the most sophisticated they ever had. You know, but that shouldn't be a surprise to anybody after 40 years of being here. And it still was. So the sort of public perception of Utah as a state versus Colorado as a state in terms of sophistication, in terms of diversity and equity and inclusion, in terms of fairness, in terms of just values, in terms of environmental stewardship, which these are values that Sundance as an organization stands for, right? Utah could not go up against Colorado in terms of air quality. We could not go up against Colorado in terms of the Great Salt Lake and the health threat to citizens or employees. We could not go up against Colorado if an employee of Sundance living in Utah had to have a medical abortion. We haven't had that law change, but that was a concern. As they were looking and evaluating at cities, those were absolutely on their checklist. And we had to make the case that Utah is a red state, but it's a very inclusive red state, that people work together and there were ways around our bathroom policy that, you know, that if we change our bathroom policy, but during this 10 days of Sundance, that Sundance would be owning and operating those venues, even if they were public venues, that we would find ways to make it be as accommodating and inclusive as we could within our state laws. But do I think they hurt us? Yes. But do I think that was the major reason? No, I think that mostly they don't understand what it's like to live here. They don't understand that Salt Lake is, by comparison to the rest of the state, a very progressive world-class run city, we actually could answer any one of those concerns, not with certainty, but with in making the case that Sundance is going to make us better. Having Sundance here makes us better. We can push back on these things when we have a cultural institution like Sundance that's applying that lens for whether we deserve to be the home state and the host state that, you know, is their partner.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about the outside impression of Salt Lake City, not Park City, because part of the idea for Sundance, of course, is to was to expand its operations into Salt Lake City. The film critic Owen Gleiberman wrote this piece in Variety that I wanted to get your response to. One of the people we were talking with this week mentioned it. He wrote this. He wrote, "The festival is arty and progressive and cosmopolitan. Salt Lake is the austere Western seat of Mormonism. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but how do these two things go together? They don't. I can imagine a Sundance Film Festival hosted by Salt Lake City feeling like an arid and oxymoronic affair." So what do you make of the impression of, well, Park City's cool, but Salt Lake City isn't, and so maybe they should go somewhere else? How do you respond to something like that?
I think that it's bad journalism. I think that they made incredible generalizations and stereotypes that are hugely outdated, yeah. And shame on them.
Yeah.
Like, they didn't do their homework. I mean, I'm used to this. Like, every time we bring somebody into the Utah Film Center, they're surprised we have good restaurants. They're surprised we have, you know, warehouses and hip areas. They're like the coffee house culture, you know, 9th and 9th, the LGBT community. Like, they're like, wow, you know, like, yeah, we don't have horns, you know, like, it's like, it's right. We still have to fight against that. And it's not fair, honestly. Mm. It's just not fair.
What difference is it going to make to Utah in 2 years when it's gone? What difference are people going to feel in this place?
Well, I mean, I think that January is going to be a very... For me personally, it's going to be just a very lonely month, right? It won't be the same. Will it be the same economically? Absolutely not. So I think there'll be a huge void. I'm hoping that some of the labs can stay here because I think that there's something very storied and sacred about the resort. You know, I hope that legacy continues. Mostly I hope it continues for Robert Redford because that was his vision and he's done a lot for artists and a lot for the state, and the resort is, you know, a beautiful place for artists to be able to get reprieve from the outside world. But that doesn't mean that that has to happen in January. So we'll just have to wait and see. I mean, I can't imagine that there'll be anything that could come close to replacing that density 2 years from now, whether we build something else or we, you know, find a way to continue to reward and encourage and nurture independent voices. I hope so. My dream would be that, of course, we continue to animate our hearts and minds and children and schools and community partners with great films and conversations, because it's been a big part of my life. And I've seen the impact it's made culturally on our community. So I hope we can figure out a way to continue that legacy. I just don't know what it looks like right now.
Geralyn Dreyfuss, thank you very much.
You're so welcome, Doug.
Geralyn Dreyfuss, she's the board chair of the Utah Film Center and co-founder of the investment group Impact Partners. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about the Sundance Film Festival, which is leaving Utah for Colorado when their contract is up at the end of next year. One of the questions center stage about Sundance is just how relevant is it, or really any festival in the changing movie culture, with the rise of streaming platforms and the dominance of digital distribution and these big budget blockbusters over independent films. Do film festivals matter anymore? It's a question we put to the film scholar Andrew Nelson.
Film festivals have served different purposes at different times, but historically they have had a few what we might call core functions. A big one was cultural prestige, and related to that would be diplomacy, actually. And along with that, of course, festivals have always served as a kind of gatekeepers or validators of artistic merit. You know, films are judged by filmmakers or by knowledgeable critics, so they can provide a platform for films, in some cases films that might not otherwise reach large audiences. And then winning at a major festival has historically had the potential to launch a filmmaker's career or change the critical trajectory of a film. You can choose to launch your film at a major festival. And in the moment, you know, a filmmaker can receive a standing ovation in the hall, but the critics can then very quickly begin writing scathing indictments of the picture, and that can more or less doom it. But then over time, especially after the 70s, many festivals became marketplaces. Mm-hmm. They offered a venue for producers to sell the distribution rights to their films. And distribution is key to film, like it is to any industry. You know, it doesn't matter if you have a great product. You need to have a distribution mechanism, a way to get that product to customers. And then also as a kind of hub for networking and pitching and deal making. And so after the 70s and later, Sundance, Toronto International Film Festival in Berlin became increasingly important to the business of film, not just to the art of film. And then that, you know, kind of takes us up to a present moment where we're maybe in a little bit of a transition about the role of the festival and what the festival means. There are more festivals than ever before right now, but I think we might get into that a little bit later.
Yeah. So when does Sundance become prestigious? Like, when does it come of age? It seems like to me, as I think back, it was Sex, Lies, and Videotape. That seemed like an iconic moment for Sundance, Soderbergh's film that comes out. And I think there may have been others, but it seems like there were these markers that brought Sundance into the larger sort of public popular attention.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I think, you know, there is a moment in the late 1980s when Sundance becomes Sundance. That moment, the breakout success of Steven Soderbergh's Sex, Lies, and Videotape in the late 80s is really what puts Sundance on the map. And, you know, he emerges at the same time. You know, he's followed shortly by others, Robert Rodriguez. Right. This is a moment where Richard Linklater are emerging. So what you have is a new generation of important, you know, intellectual, sophisticated, smart, funny, savvy, independent filmmakers against the backdrop of this festival that serves as a showcase for this very type of work. So it's kind of a great moment of confluence, let's say, between the two. And, you know, really that is the origin of the modern Sundance, the idea that, you know, this quirky independent film can make its way into this festival, and there it will be exposed to a wide audience who will appreciate it for what it is. The film will then have a launching pad, and it will affect fundamental shifts in how, you know, how movies are made.
So Sundance very much made a difference to the creation, the making, the distribution of films.
It did. Well, some films.
Right. I mean,
we need to remember that, you know, any big festival is only going to accept a small fraction of the films that are submitted to it. So there's a certain amount of, I think, luck involved. And most programmers I've met at festivals, you know, will admit that, you know, luck is part of it. You know, sometimes they've made mistakes, so on and so forth. But yes, I mean, that's the idea, that this is going to serve as a launching pad for your film. And so it can make a significant difference. I mean, it can be the difference between, at least historically, people seeing your film and people not seeing it.
So how connected was the Sundance Film Festival ever to Utah beyond like that, those initial days? I mean, beyond the practical stuff, you know, the location, it's here. So that's obviously a connection. But was Sundance ever aligned with Utah in any other important way?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, there's no question that Sundance's identity was tied to Utah, or perhaps more specifically to Park City. Mm-hmm. And that might be an important distinction. I think that is an important distinction, actually. But unlike, you know, say a Toronto International Film Festival, which, you know, kind of emerged around the same time and came at its peak to occupy a kind of similar role in the film marketplace. So unlike Toronto, where many of the core leadership and staff have longstanding local ties, you know, Sundance leadership has typically been drawn from, you know, the national film industry, especially from New York and Los Angeles. Right. You know, Redford himself, though associated with Utah through his resort at Sundance, was not a product of Utah culture. His influence came from his stature in Hollywood and, you know, a substantial portion of Sundance's year-round operations, press, programming, industry relations, long been based in Los Angeles. So there's, you know, one perspective is that the Park City Festival was more of a stage than a headquarters. It was a place for, you know, screenings and premieres and parties, but not day-to-day decision making. So it's not as though it's not a part of the Utah story that, you know, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of Utahns have helped make Sundance what it is, but it, you know, isn't necessarily in its, you know, let's say iteration from the late 80s onward, an indigenous Utah phenomena. You know, I read when Sundance was considering leaving, there was an article in Variety by a film critic who had been going to Sundance for, I think, 25 years. And it was interesting to read because it was a criticism of the new joint Sundance Salt Lake City bid. And it was this person just couldn't imagine spending any time whatsoever in Salt Lake City. But the Salt Lake City that they described was like the Salt Lake City of 1975. It was not,
right.
It was not the, you know,
we don't have any restaurants. We don't have any cachet, nothing sophisticated here.
You know,
right.
The idea of taking a, you know, so this is a person from LA and, you know, the idea of in Utah taking a half hour drive from one cinema to another, is somehow inconceivable. But it was, you know, it was a vision of the city, maybe the state, you know, pre-Winter Olympics. I mean, pre-21st century in some cases. Yeah. So, but, you know, that was an important thing for me to read because it made me realize that, you know, for a lot of people, they weren't actually coming to Utah. It wasn't about Salt Lake City. It is about Park City. They would get off at the airport. They would go to Park City. They would spend their time in this pristine mountain town, which they perceived to be, you know, culturally, maybe politically distinct from the rest of the state, and then they would go home and they would never experience anything else in the state. Now, this is a cynical take, and I'm basing it on just one person's perspective, but I think there was something to that.
So it makes me wonder, can you then just take a festival and consider it as this product that's interchangeable? You can just, you know, pull up stakes and move to another mountain town.
Yeah.
You know, those are the Flatirons. This is the Wasatch Range. It sort of looks the same. And it won't matter. I guess the question is it interchangeable?
I mean, this is the, you know, the $64,000 question, because there aren't really a lot of precedents for this. So the short answer is that, you know, we're going to see. You know, will people still travel from around the world to go to Sundance? If it's not in Park City, Utah, I have to think they probably will if they're going for, first and foremost, the festival, the experience, the movies, you know, the opportunity to be herded like cattle.
Yeah.
Although, you know, maybe that won't be as much of an issue in Boulder, although I will say, kind of as an, maybe this is an aside, the description of Boulder in a lot of the press, at least to me, was, you know, very different than what my, you know, colleagues and people I know at CU Boulder describe Boulder as. I mean, one told me that, you know, Boulder is basically Park City on steroids. So if your goal was sort of egalitarianism and access and equality and not a place that was like, you know, Patagonia meets a Subaru meets a trust fund, then mm-hmm. you know, you haven't strayed that far. So I mean, maybe it is interchangeable. We'll have to see. I mean, certainly the festival they felt like they could leave. And, you know, given the even the long list of places they were considering, it was clear that there was a belief among the people in the organization that they had a strong brand, and it was the brand that you could relocate somewhere else. And this, you know, that is what's distinct about Sundance. You know, it was never the Utah Film Festival. Even in its inception, it was the U.S. Film Festival.
Robert Redford has expressed, you know, gratitude to Utah for all the past support, but he's released a statement saying basically he's okay with the change, said in a statement, change is inevitable and we must always evolve and grow. So in that sense, what's going to happen to film festivals in this digital streaming era? What do you think is the future?
Yeah. A common perspective is that, you know, the role of festival has changed and that many festivals have drifted from their founding ideals, let's say. So, you know, the cliched example would be the Taylor Swift documentary from a few years ago. Yeah. You know, does that film need to premiere at Sundance for it to do well at the box office? No, of course not. And yet that's what happened. But that's indicative of, you know, larger changes that many times big films will play at festivals having already secured distribution. So the market function is not as significant as it once was before. We've seen the film industry shift where we now have streamers in addition to studios that makes it a little bit more complex. So, you know, the landscape is changing. I think, you know, the big festivals, the Sundance, the TIFF, still continue to have that market function. I think that function, you know, continues, but is not as important as it once was. I think the laurels that you get from a festival, you know, can help. But, you know, what I see is festivals becoming much more audience-driven events than they were historically. You know, certainly festivals like Sundance and TIFF, you know, tout themselves as being very audience friendly. But they're still, you know, these are still massive operations with complicated systems for getting tickets and the you know, becomes an exercise in logistics and so on, which is very different than a festival held in a single place with a smaller number of people. So I see a lot of festivals today on this smaller scale, you know, catering to audiences in ways that some of these big festivals don't. Because these festivals have to satisfy the audiences, otherwise they won't turn out. So they're, you know, engaging local communities, you know, focusing on boosting cultural tourism, you know, without the market pressures that maybe began to contort some of the other festivals over the course of the late 20th century. I think that's exciting. But, you know, is a festival going to make or break your film? Not necessarily in the way that it might have in the past.
So Sundance is moving. Does anyone care about this except for us?
I think so. I mean, you know, I'm going to contradict myself a little bit here. And I have heard from people who, you know, can't imagine Sundance being anywhere else. But, you know, I have to be honest that I could always imagine Sundance being someplace else. You know, I loved working with Sundance. You know, the people there were great. They were, you know, they were invested in the community, you know, when I had the privilege of being chair of the Department of Film and Media Arts at the University of Utah, you know, worked with many people at Sundance who were, you know, earnestly engaged in looking beyond the festival and thinking for ways to engage the local community, Utah, outside of the few weeks of the festival. So, you know, so it's sad to have that kind of, you know, cultural resource go, especially if you're interested in film. But my impression, just being honest, was that, you know, in a certain sense, Sundance was a festival that just happened to be in Utah. It didn't have to be here. And obviously the festival agrees with that. Otherwise they wouldn't be moving. So it's, you know, it's a great loss, but, you know, at the same time, you know, the media landscape has changed. So, you know, the idea that any film that's playing in a festival, that's going to be your only chance to see it. That's rarely the case anymore. I mean, eventually you're going to be able to have access to almost any film that plays at any festival from the comfort of your living room. Not every film, you know, we don't want to be, you know, technological idealists here or utopian in our thinking, but it's changed. So, you know, if what you care about is access to the films, then, you're not really losing that. And then if what you're interested in is festivals, there are other festivals in Utah. You know, you've got a strong organization in the Utah Film Center. You've got the Salt Lake Film Society running films festivals year round. So if what you crave is the exposure to new films in a social environment, you know, where the directors are there, where you can engage in knowledgeable conversation, you can still do that. And, you know, and that's the case now, almost, you know, any large or mid-sized city. So is something lost? Yes. But, you know, are there not replacements nearby, at hand? I think there are.
Andrew Nelson, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Andrew Nelson, he's a film scholar and the chief curator of Western Spirit, Scottsdale's Museum of the West. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Our intern is Katrina Cano, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.